Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET for DSL Extreme.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, February 10th, 2008. On the Premier Radio Networks, this is show 430. Enjoy. How are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're ready to talk tech. Are you? Woo-hoo. All right. No strain, no pressure. It's all right. Relax your brain. Just let the tech wash over you. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. I'd love to talk to you right now if you want to talk about high tech. That's 8888 Ask Leo. Let me say that high tech could be your home theater system, your HDTV. It could be your camcorder or your MP3 player. It could be your digital camera. I love talking about photography. It could be your computer. Yeah, of course. I'm not going to leave computers out. They're the digital hub. I remember asking, I can't remember if it was Andy Grove, Paul Adelini, one of the head guy at Intel. Depends what year I talked to him. But anyway, I remember asking him, I said, well, you know, what's going to happen to the computer because of, look at the iPod and the cell phones. And, you know, do we need computers anymore? Do we need big machines in the living room or in the office anymore? He said, yes, always. Of course, he sells the chips that make computers. But yes, always. They're the digital hub. They're the, and that makes sense, right? They're the place that all this stuff plugs into. Even your TV now, you know, is getting video and audio and pictures and, you know, content from your computer sometimes if you have a, you know, little Apple TV or one of those D-length media centers or so, yeah, or an Xbox or a PS3. So, yeah, I guess it makes sense. The computer is the digital hub. We'll talk about that. Talk about the internet, Web 2.0, Web 3.0, Web 4.0. I don't know. None of it means anything. We'll talk about any point oh you want to. 8888 Ask Leo's a number. That's 888-827-5536. And, anything goes. There's no question too simple, too dumb. Simpler is the better. I'm simple. I'm a simple guy. Simple questions, good for me. I'll take it. Digital boxes are going to go on sale this week for the digital converters. You're going to start seeing a lot of ads. I saw Comcast already do one. Honey, the digital converters are on sale. Do we need one?
No, we don't need one of those. We've got Comcast.
Actually, as silly as it is, I think it is important to reassure everybody. If you're on cable or satellite, you don't need to worry about this digital conversion. But a year from now, almost to the day, all of those analog broadcast television stations, you know, channel 2, channel 5, channel 7, they're all going to go digital. And if you don't have a digital receiver, all of a sudden, this is what you'll get. Nothing. You won't even get a, ooh, you get a, nothing. Because that frequency is now going to revert back to the federal government, who will auction it off for trillions of dollars and everybody wins. Well, except for us. Oops, I forgot. We don't win because all of a sudden, our television sets no longer work. Now, again, this is only if you're getting your TV from a rabbit ears, from a, you know, big antenna on the roof, or if you're getting over-the-air, OTA television. So they're converting to digital, and you'll have to get a box. Now, the good news is the boxes are going on sale this week. I wouldn't run out and get one. I would wait and see if prices go down a little bit. The government is offering a rebate, I think a $40 rebate. If you go to dtv.gov, you can read about it and you can find, you know, all the answers. They have the right at the top. Countdown to DTV transition. 373 days, 12 hours, 49 minutes and 28 seconds. February 17th, which, by the way, will be the second anniversary of this show.
2009. So you, if you're watching with rabbit ears, you're going to have to buy a little box. And I have to admit, the digital elite, like people like me, going, oh, well, who still watches over-the-air TV? Well, more than half of America, as it turns out, still watches through rabbit ears. So it is a significant number of people. There is a government voucher program. You can apply if you go right to the front page of dtv.gov. You can apply for the coupon that'll take you to the, I think it's a $40 voucher. Now, how much are these things going to cost? More than that, but not a lot more than that. So it's heavily subsidized. The box will then connect to your antenna. It would be prudent to get a different antenna, but it may well work depending on how close you are to the signal. You plug it into the digital box, and the digital box converts that signal into the same old analog signal you've been using all along, and then that hooks up to the TV. So you can use your 12-inch Sylvania. If you still want to, the black and white, you can still use it, but you will need this in a year. You'll need this translation thing. And now, those of you who are watching, and I imagine, at least for this audience, that's most of you who are watching on satellite or cable, you're already digital. It doesn't impact you at all. It's only if you want to watch the over-the-air stations. And when I say channels 2, you know, 4, 5, 7, all 9, you could be watching those on your cable box. You're still fine. It's only if you have an antenna that you have to worry about this. They're going on sale, though, this week. You'll be able to get one. Oh, isn't that exciting? I just have to... I don't live close enough to a broadcast signal to actually use this. I wish I could. Because, I hate the idea of having to pay for TV. Maybe that's my age showing. It's funny because we went through a stage where TV was free, radio's still free. Then we went to pay TV, just kind of sort of going to pay radio with satellite, right? And now the kids today, they don't want to pay for anything, so they're just watching YouTube, and they're back to free. Grammy Awards are tonight. Speaking of YouTube, 50th Grammys, and YouTube's going to play a big role. Last year at the Grammys... Remember the band, is it Ready Go? Or is that the song? I think it's a song. I can't remember the band's name. But then they were on the conveyor belts. Really creative music video that they made cheaply. I think it was one of the band members' sisters with a camcorder and a bunch of treadmills. And it was a wonderful video. And they showed that. Actually, they did it live, didn't they, at the Grammys last year? Well, the Grammys are even more YouTube this year. YouTube has arranged to allow the site's viewers to vote on their favorite string renditions of a Foo Fighters song, The Pretender. And what they did is they went to YouTube users. YouTube's a website where you can watch video. They went to YouTube users and said, okay, make a string rendition of The Pretender, put it on YouTube, and then all the YouTube users voted. And the top 15 choices, the top 15 players are all going to be on stage at the Grammys. Violinists, cellists, trumpet players from all over the world. I'll tell you what, I'll put a link in the show notes to the winners. Or you just go to youtube.com/mygrammymoment. And you can watch the top 15. All of whom will be playing on stage. I don't know if any of them will get solos. They'll be playing as an ensemble. I think that's kind of neat. So there's just instrumentalists on a variety of instruments playing the song. And they're going to all play together. They've been rehearsing for like 2 weeks, so they better sound good. They've been in LA for a long time because they probably needed the rehearsal. It's interesting how the music industry is kind of, they're trying a little rapprochement with online. They're trying to figure it out, frankly. They don't get it. They can't understand it. They have no idea what's going on. They're doing their best, trying to figure out how do we be online? How do we participate in the online world without them stealing us blind, those thieves? Well, they go on MySpace. That's really what MySpace was all about originally. MySpace was the site that
it originally, before the kids found it, independent musicians would go to and they'd create pages for themselves. And then the kids found the pages. And then, you know, it became a great kind of social place for all kinds of people. But it originally, and I think in many ways is still influenced by this, is about music. YouTube getting a little heat over the last couple of weeks. There is an atheist group on YouTube, 35,000 strong, largest group in the world. The Atheist and Agnostic Group. They got hacked. Hackers broke in and renamed the site from the Atheist and Agnostic Group to Jesus is Love. I know a few of you will be sympathetic with that. However, it is a hack, and the group petitioned to MySpace saying, please, can you change that back? It's not exactly our message. And MySpace didn't for a month, and then they pulled it down. They knocked them off. Well, a lot of people got upset by that, a lot of petitions circulating, and they're back. MySpace restored the site. I think the pressure they were under, pressure from both sides. I think a lot of believers said, get these guys off of here. What do you think? Do they have a right to be? I think they have a right to be there. I think that, you know, it's not like a hate group, or is it? Maybe you feel it is. I guess you could say that, you know, if that's your firmly held belief, that a non-believer is a hate group, do they have a right to be on MySpace? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Grammys. They don't have writers, but they have YouTube. Maybe they'll have writers. Looks like that writer strike's going to finally come to a close. And all the video podcasters who've been jumping up and down saying, it's our turn. There's nothing to watch on TV. You can watch us. I think they've been a little disappointed. Somehow the networks managed to find something to put on there, and people still watched it. But people like great, great video podcasts like Ask a Ninja and Tiki Bar. We're hoping. Let's talk about it. 8888 Ask Leo. There's a lot to talk about. I'm Leo Laborde, the tech guy. Talk about technology. John in Pasadena, California. John, you're first on the show. Good day to you. How are you today?
Hi there, Leo. Great. I bought a store-bought CD of all things, and I brought it home and tried to put it into my Mac, and all the songs except for the last two downloaded into the library, and those two were all jumpy. Huh. So I took it back to the store thinking, it was defective, got another one, and it same thing happened, last two songs, but in a different way slightly, like a different time and so forth. So I was just wondering if you knew what's going on.
You know, your first guess would be, oh, it's copy protection, but it probably isn't. If it doesn't say, you know, protected on the disc, it's not copy protected. What happens is, as it gets closer to the last songs, it has to spin faster, the CD. Uh-huh. And so probably what's happening is it's getting a little wobble in there.
Huh.
My recommendation when you're importing on iTunes is to go into the settings, and you want to go to the importing settings, use error. Did you try this? Use error correction.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it was clicked off. And
turn that on.
Off.
Well, have it checked.
On.
Use. You want error correction when reading audio CDs? They say it'll slow it down. Good. It does not. And in fact, I leave it on all the time. It generally will give you a little bit better result. So what's happening is it's spinning really fast. How old is that that Mac?
Well, it's fairly new, like a year or two.
Yeah, it's what happens nowadays is these spin really fast as they're importing because it's trying to import really fast. And and you're probably getting a little vibration in it.
Huh, okay, because it plays perfectly on the CD player, and that's why I didn't know if
it doesn't spin as fast on the CD player.
Or not,
right,
so.
An audio CD plays at 1X. That's in fact where 1X, 2X, 4X, 8X, 16X,
right.
That's where that comes from.
And so forth,
But when it's importing, it does it much faster than real time, you might have noticed.
Yes, I did.
And that's because it's...
Until I hit the glitchy part, and then it became like one...
Yeah, it's having a hard time reading it. It may well... It will, in that case, error correction will slow it down considerably. So okay. I'm not, you know, I don't know if there's a quick fix for this.
Yeah. Well, it was a Black Sabbath CD, so I thought it might
Oh, that's it. It's you've got Satan in there. It could be Satan. That's interesting. It doesn't happen with other CDs?
Not that I've had so far. No, none of my other store-bought CDs have ever had this happen.
Yeah.
So
It may have jammed a lot more onto that CD. Is it a really long CD?
It's a double album. Double album. So they cut out a couple songs.
Exactly. They went to the very edge of the CD, and as you get to the last tracks, it spins faster.
Yeah.
So I think that's all that's going on. Is it's just not. It's getting some jitter in there. Now there are other ways to import. On the PC, there are a lot of alternative programs that probably do a better job. And what I'd really like to find is something that could say, don't try to import it so fast. Slow down. Because if you could keep it spinning a little slower, it would import better. I don't see anything in iTunes that'll let you do that. But let me see if there's another, you know, because iTunes is so dominant, because it's just the program on the Mac. It pretty much killed all the, you know, there used to be a lot of other MP3 playing, ripping, you know, burning, and all of that's kind of gone. Because, you know, who wants to compete with Apple? That's the negative. It's unfortunate. You see this sometimes in Windows as well. When Microsoft, like with Office, is a big player, all the other guys go away. And that's not good for us. You know, as users, what we want is a variety of choices. And if there were competition, somebody would come along and say, you know, I really should write a program that imports these tough to import CDs better. There may be one. Let me look. But I'm pretty sure that's what's going on. Dan in Simi Valley, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Dan.
Hi there. Love your show.
Thank you, sir.
I got a question about using Windows Vista Ultimate 32-bit or 64-bit for twin gaming machines.
Almost certainly you should use 32-bit.
Okay.
There's very little advantage in 64-bit. Even though we have 64-bit processors, all that means is it can operate on larger chunks of data. And really the biggest difference is you get, for an end user, is you get more RAM. You can access more RAM. 32-bit Vista is limited to 4 gigs, and you don't even get all of that 4 gigs because some of that address space is used for the video card and other resources. So you never even get, you know, you get like 3-point-something gigs. But
I experienced that with my laptop.
Exactly. Okay. That's probably okay. I mean, most games don't expect 4 gigs of RAM. That would be the only advantage. The disadvantage of 64-bit is compatibility. And the reason I say if you're a gamer, that's probably not a good choice is one of the chief areas of compatibility will be video card drivers.
Right.
They have to be signed 64-bit drivers. What Microsoft decided was, okay, we'll make 32-bit Vista more compatible. We'll make 64-bit more secure, sacrificing some compatibility. So what you see is a more secure operating system. It's for heavy-duty users who need lots of RAM, maybe servers, but they have to go through a couple of extra hoops. They have more headaches because not all drivers work. They have to be special drivers. Even some software may choke on 64-bit. And you for gaming, I don't think you'd get a big improvement unless some games if they're using massive textures and they're kind of aware of this and they might take advantage of it. And they certainly could take advantage of it. I don't know of any games yet that say better with 64-bit.
I'm not aware of any myself.
No. But keep an eye out. Remember, we said the same thing about multiprocessors. For a long time.
It'll take some time, but
yeah,
sure.
It just takes a while. For a long time, you know, you could have a Core 2, but no game would take advantage of it. Now they all do. Or at least all the newer, higher-end ones. Thanks for the call, Dan. Leo Laporte, I am the tech guy. More calls coming up.
Tech Guy is brought to you by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or visit them online at dslextreme.com.
Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. And we are going to talk right now to one of my favorite guys. You know I like talking about digital photography.
Mikkel Olland is the author of Shooting Raw, a wonderful book about using the RAW format. He is also a longtime photographer, studied with some of the greats, including Ansel Adams, who told him, shoot digital, young man, go digital. So that's a shooting digital, I should say, not shooting RAW. Shooting Digital is the name of his book. He also wrote Photoshop CS2 RAW about Adobe Camera RAW. And wrote, I think, probably my favorite book of all time for photography. If you use Lightroom, you got to have it. It's the Adobe Lightroom Adventure, which is both a beautiful photography book with some of the best photographs from the people like Michael Reichman, Bill Atkinson, who wrote, I think he wrote Mac Paint and many other great Apple programs for the early Mac. So they went to Finland, they took beautiful pictures, and then they used the new, at the time, Adobe Lightroom to process them, and then Mikkel wrote the book about how they modified their pictures, how they made their pictures look better. So Shooting Raw, Shooting Digital, Photoshop CS2 Raw, and now Adobe Lightroom Adventure. And he was at PMA. Hello, Mikkel, how are you?
Hey, Leo, I'm well. How are you?
Oh, you still got that cold, don't you?
You know, I've been in Los Angeles. That'll give it to you.
The conference cold he's got.
Yes.
So you were at Las Vegas. You were at the PMA last week, which is the photo marketing show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you went there with an eye towards right digital photography.
Yeah, it's hard not to do that when you go down there. What a great show. It's a chance for all of us, you know, super geeks to get down there and put our hands on some really fine new stuff that's just come out.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you see that you liked? What did you find interesting?
Well, you know, Leo, there's so much. You've been to these shows before. They're overwhelming. So what us journalists or photographers do is we gather in the press room
and say, what do you like? What's cool? What's new? Yeah.
What's going on?
Right.
And then, so that's fun to do. And the other thing is we kind of sort through all kinds of rumors and things too,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
That's one of the great things about these shows is that you can kind of get a heads up what's coming down the pipe. And I went in there just with a lot of things in my mind. I was curious about when Canon's going to come out with a new successor to the 5D, which is a very popular digital SLR that's been out for a while now, actually since 2005. So I was sniffing around trying to find out more about a successor to that. They didn't announce anything officially. So
good, because I bought a 5D and I don't want to have to buy a new one.
Oh, yeah. I guess when these rumors start rolling around,
it's when I buy
one. Start getting good prices.
Right. No, I love the 5D. I'm really happy with it. And, of course, Nikon did announce one of the things that makes the 5D so special is its 35mm sensor. And Nikon, which has not had one until now, did announce a camera with one. And Sony, I saw, announced a camera with one.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Sony. That's on my list here of things that we were all kind of comparing notes on. I'm pretty excited about the Sony's jumping into this digital SLR market in a big way. You know, they bought Minolta, and so they kind of inherited some really nice technology from them. But they're also, they've announced a full-size sensor that it sounds amazing, 24.8 megapixels.
Holy cow.
Whoa. But it's the full-size sensor that I think that we're all pretty excited about. The idea that our lenses that we're used to with 35mm film will have the same ratio. So we'll get a true wide angle.
So when you have a 28mm lens, it shoots 28mm. Most digital SLRs, you multiply it by 1.5 or 1.6.
Or 1.6 or something like that.
Yeah.
So that the Sony thing, I think a lot of people are looking at Sony now as a big player in that whole digital SLR space.
And do they make good lenses? I know they have the Zeiss name,
mm-hmm.
but are they good lenses?
I think many, many years ago, and I'd date myself if I say when, but when Sony first jumped into the digital cameras, people were expecting great things, but they came out with the plastic lenses that were part of their camcorder business, and they were very poor. But then they jumped over to, and started working with Zeiss and came up with amazing optics, and okay. I've just been so impressed with Sony.
Now, how much is that going to be, a 22-megapixel camera full frame with a Zeiss optics? That's going to cost a lot of money, right?
Well, yeah, I bet. But you know, it's very competitive space right now with the like you mentioned earlier, with the Nikon camera out there with the full size frame, around $5,000.
Yeah,
and the Canon has their 8,000.
Oh yeah, you can get more expensive. I know. Yeah, but the 5D is really only around 3,000, I think. Right?
Exactly. Well, 2,000.
2,000. Wow.
Yeah. So that's a very competitive 2,000 to 3,000,
right,
depending
on
where
the
you
lens.
Get it. But
yeah.
Well, then that's the body, and
right.
Yeah. Of course,
yeah.
The lens costs more, but it's becoming a very competitive space, and we'll see. And Sony, as you know, they're very aggressive marketing wise and
yeah.
Price wise. So
Nikon did announce a D300 follow up to their D200, has been a very popular kind of mid range digital SLR.
That has been everybody at the show had. I mean, not everybody, of course. I'm embellishing this a little bit, but it seemed like everybody had their D300 they were walking around with, and I think that's really what's got Canon a little bit, moving towards the seven, the successor to the 5D is that the success of the Nikon D300, which frankly is a phenomenal camera.
Is it as good as a 5D?
Well, you know, it's going to be hard to. I haven't seen the head-to-head on that, but
it's not full frame.
It's not a full frame, but you know, there's a lot to be said for getting that multiplier, the 1.5 multiplier.
Right.
You know, that means your telephotos become even more of a telephoto.
True.
So there's people that actually like the multiplier.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, but you do get better pictures the more. The size you have per pixel, the better the picture looks, I think.
You know, you're right. This whole the whole megapixel race is.
It's not about the number of pixels. Yeah, it's about the.
Not.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nikon, especially with the D3, which is their full size sensor, they went the opposite route. They said we're not going to try to compete with the Canon, D1DS Mark III 21.1 megapixel. They said we're going to go with 12.1 megapixels. But what they did is they went their sensors went from 6.4 microns to 8.5. And what that means with the bigger the micron sensor, micro lens sensor, you can get these huge ISOs. For example, with the D3, you can get an ISO of 25,000, over 25,000.
This is light sensitivity. And normally your range is maybe 100 to 1,600.
Yeah.
25,000?
Oh, it's unbelievable, Leo. So this is what everybody's so excited about. People realize that it's not just about pixel count, but there's other factors as well. And this is where people are really excited that they can go into a night situation and not have to use a flash and get these incredible shots.
Yeah.
with these larger micro lens sensors.
That's pretty neat. Now, how about point and shoots? Did you see anything interesting in the compact cameras?
You know, the point and shoot thing is it's unbelievable now, what they're offering. I think, again, we've reached the limits in terms of, I mean, there's always going to be people that are going to buy things based on the megapixels. But, you know, anything over 8, frankly, we're starting to get, you're starting to get into extra pixels. So what I'm looking for now in these point and shoots, there's a couple things. But there the other features, like, for example, the ability to do mini movies or video.
Right.
And there's some pretty neat stuff coming out now in terms of video quality. I have a one of my favorite, I guess you call it a point and shoot. It's a Leica, the Deluxe 3.
Yeah, okay.
It's
kind of a high-end point and shoot.
Well, it's made by Panasonic, so you can go out and buy the Panasonic version for $200 less.
Oh,
yes, exactly the same camera.
That's a good tip.
I'm just a snob, and I like the Leica name, buy the 200. But this camera here, the video on this camera, it does a 16.9, 30 frames per second.
Is it high def?
Yeah. And it's I'm not sure if it's true high def, but it really is amazing video quality. So the cameras now are starting to move away from how many megapixels you can get, but features like that, face recognition is another big thing now with these point and shoots. I'm talking about $200-$300 cameras too, where you can get this built-in face recognition, so it tracks, it knows when there's a face in the picture, and it will track the face and make the optimal exposure and as well focus. So they're building a lot of this intelligence into the cameras now that are going beyond pixels and making them much more feature-laden.
Now, I wanted to know what you think about the new Sigma. They announced a Sigma point-and-shoot using the Foveon.
Here we go again with the Foveon.
Just to fill people in, is that, you know, right now cameras use either CCD or more likely CMOS technology for these light pickups that are basically the film in a digital camera. And right. Carver Mead, who's a famous physicist, came up with this kind of new way of doing it called the Foveon chip, which everybody got very excited about when he announced it, and nobody's using except Sigma. I think Polaroid, the late, great Polaroid, announced that they were going to do a camera with it, but that didn't happen. And for the first time now, they're going to have a point and shoot. Will this be something to look at?
Obviously. I think Foveon is very interesting technology. The basic concept is that right now, the sensor itself... Don't worry, Leo. I won't go too technical here because we could go really down a rabbit hole if we wanted to on this. But real simply, most of these sensors now have a sensor for red, a sensor for green, and a sensor for blue. So these are separate pixels for each one of those colors, and there's always twice as many green pixels than red and blue because we're more sensitive to that. So what the Foveon chip did is say instead of designating one pixel per color, why don't we try to make each pixel sensitive to the three RGB, the RGB values, and which in a way then you have much more effective use of your pixels. It's a brilliant concept. It's really great. The problem was it just didn't work exactly as they thought. You know, in real life, it didn't produce the quality that we were expecting. So I think we're all kind of, it's a wait-and-see thing right now. I think we're all just waiting to see.
We are out of time, Mikkel. There's so much more to talk about. Can you actually stick around a few more minutes, can you? Because I want to ask you about Polaroid. All right, Mikkel Olin is our guest. We're talking about digital photography. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. We're talking about digital photography with Mikkel Olin. He is one of my favorite photo guys, the author of so many great books, including Shooting Digital. His website is shooting-digital.com. And his latest book, Photoshop Lightroom Adventure, is, I think, without a doubt, the best photography book. If you're using Lightroom, it's a must-have. It's just because you have so many great images in it. And then it teaches you how to use Lightroom, which I personally am a big fan of. I've become a huge fan of Lightroom. Hey, Mikkel.
Hey, Leo.
Thanks for hanging on. I hope you can.
Oh, I love talking to you. You know that. You're the man.
So we'll all go out and get, what is it, the DP1, this Sigma, and just see what it does.
Yeah, let's try it out. There's some really interesting new sensor technologies coming down the pipe, and you know, it's a really exciting time for digital photography. I got to tell you, I'm so thrilled to be involved with it. It used to be so much about pain, you know, just to getting things to work and to get anything out of these cameras back in the old days, and we're way over that now. And it's really just about having a good time shooting now.
I'm
thrilled.
I'm seeing better photography than ever before, too, from everybody.
I am too. Yeah. Absolutely, Leo. It's just these cameras, they really free up the creativity in people, and it's really fun to watch. And also just the quality. I mean, we started talking about the point and shoots, and you asked me about that earlier. And some of the things, one of the developments that's happening that's pretty exciting for me, at least, is that some of these now are also being able to capture in the RAW file format. For example, the Leica that I mentioned earlier captures RAW. But Canon also their new G9, which is just a super. I think it's a $400 camera.
You get so much for $400 in that camera.
Oh, that is just a smashing hit, the G9, and that's now saving also in the RAW format. So I'm excited about that because you know me and RAW. I'm Mr. RAW. I just love what you can pull out of that RAW data.
Right.
And that obviously you mentioned the books and that's what the books are a lot about, is going in and taking that RAW data and making just extraordinary quality with that information.
Well, even Lightroom, when you use Lightroom, you want to start with a RAW image. I mean, that's kind of what it's designed to do.
And that was the pain earlier of shooting RAW, was that you get these RAW files and you go, what do I do with them? And
and
it was so much information to process. But now with the program from Adobe, Photoshop Lightroom, as they call it, you can have 1,000 RAW images and work with them just so quick, so fast. You can change all the white balance settings almost instantly on all of them because you're not working on the actual file. This is a whole new way of editing called non-destructive photo editing,
right,
where you actually create, it's like a database. You're just creating a set of instructions that work on the image, the original image file, but you don't touch the original file. So it can be very fast. And with these type of applications out there now, shooting RAW makes a lot of sense.
Do you think, I mean, most amateurs, though, should they shoot RAW? Or, I mean, most compact cameras don't still.
Correct, but I think there are always people out there, amateurs or serious amateurs, I guess, or amateurs that want to get quality at certain times. So
right,
there's some shots like a landscape shot or the beautiful sunset where they just say, I want quality here,
right,
and it's really nice to know that if you want that quality, you can just dial it in and you can switch from JPEG to RAW if you've got a camera that will do that. So you don't always have to shoot RAW. No, I mean, I think that's unfair to say that, but to know that you have that option and then to be able to work it and know that there's software out there it's not that complicated to get this really incredible quality from. I think that's the important point, not that you should always shoot RAW.
Is there anything around $200 that is a good choice in a compact camera? I think that's probably for a lot of people, that's the price they want. They want to get around $200.
And I get that question all the time. You know, what's a $200 to $250 camera?
Right. That's kind of the magic price point.
Yeah, it really is. And frankly, you know, I tell people, you know, I'm not plugging Costco for any reason other than to say that there's places like Costco that you go in and you look at that price point and you look at either a Sony or you can look at a Nikon or you look at a Canon or
they're
you look at
good.
A Casio.
Yeah.
And you know what, Leo? They're really good.
They're all good. The Kodaks?
They're really good.
I wouldn't normally say Kodak, but the Kodaks are excellent.
No, the codecs are great. I mean, I'm just what you're getting for that price point now, compared to even 5 years ago or 3 years ago, for that matter. You just can't go wrong. So you go in there and pick up the camera and see how it feels in your hand, because that's really important. And get the size. I mean, if you get something that feels right, you'll carry it with it. You'll carry it with you. You'll use it. That's the whole point. Get a camera that you feel comfortable taking with you everywhere.
You wrote the book on Photoshop Elements also, Photoshop mm-hmm. Elements Solutions for. Does that also handle RAW?
Yes, of course. That's another great pathway to working with.
Because that's a $100 program now.
Oh, or many, some cameras come, it comes free
come with
in it.
Yeah.
What a great program. Photoshop Elements, it's Photoshop kind of toned down a little bit. In Photoshop, it's an $800 program. Photoshop Elements is a wonderful application that will please most people out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, not on the Mac, but soon think they're coming back.
No, it's on the Mac. No, they're back up to speed. That was just a little hiccup there.
Oh, good.
It wasn't fun. It was like, what are you guys doing? But they're back on track now, and we're looking good on Elements. I'm actually pushing Lightroom a lot because a Lightroom Elements combination.
You could do the two together.
Absolutely.
Now that's pricey because Lightroom's $300, so.
You know, it's $299 list, but you can find it. Let me tell you, it's competitive, and okay. I've seen it. You know, $150, $200, and then if you have a copy of Elements, you put those two together, and you are set.
That's pretty nice.
It's like you can go anywhere you want to go. Then
maybe we'll go to Tasmania or somewhere. That would be kind of fun.
You know, Leo, I've been thinking about that. would you come with me as far as Tasmania? It's the end of the world, you know.
I can't wait. I'm really excited.
No, we should do that sometime, okay? Let's do it.
You know, and it's interesting. I'm more and more, you know, I've been playing with all the lenses, and, you know, I get the kit and get the whole thing. And more, I'm just shooting with that 50-millimeter, fast 50-millimeter lens. I just like going around with a digital SLR and a 50-millimeter lens, and I just some of my favorite pictures just that way. Mikkel Holland's page is shooting-digital.com. That's the name of one of his many books, Photoshop Lightroom Adventures, another one I highly recommend from O'Reilly. And we'll talk again real soon, Mikkel. Thanks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Good day to you, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo's the number. 888-827-5536. We've got more from the Photo Marketing Show coming up in about half an hour with our gadget guru, Ron Rosberg. Talk about some of the new cameras there. I'm proclaiming this the year of digital photography. It really is. We ran out of time. I would like to ask Mikkel what he thinks of the end of Polaroid. That's kind of sad. We talked about that yesterday. Polaroid announced no more. They're going to stop making their film in one more. I think it's another year. And you won't be able to buy Polaroid film anymore. They've stopped selling the cameras a year ago. Kind of the end of the line. Company that once was 21,000 employees strong, now down to 150. Oh, it's kind of sad. But that's what happens with technology, isn't it? Stuff changes. And you got to move fast to keep up. Plus the stock market. I mean, the stock market has got this Jones for growth rate. If you're a tech company and you grew 20% last year, you better darn well grow another 20% this year, or you're doing poorly. You only grow 10%. Oh, you're in trouble. You're still growing, but from the stock market's point of view, you're in trouble. And it's hard to maintain these double digit growth rates. Products mature. It's hard. Look at the iPod. That's why Apple's been telling people, look, don't expect iPod sales to continue at this rate forever, this torrid pace. Pretty soon, everybody who wants one is going to have one. And I think that's happened. And it's hard for Apple to make any, you know, major shifts to recreate the market. I think that's why Microsoft is trying to buy Yahoo. By the way, the latest on that, according to the Wall Street Journal, the Yahoo board has said no. We will not sell for $44.6 billion. We're worth more. $44.6 billion. We're worth more. They kind of sent a signal. I don't know if they're going to tell Microsoft this, but they sent a signal through the journal that they want $40 a share, not a measly $31. That only adds $12 billion to the price. Yeah, a mere $12 billion. Well, that's 12. You know, once you're spending $44 billion, what's another 12? The numbers get so big, they just kind of blur. Jeff's on the line from Spring Hill, Florida. Hey, Jeff, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How's it going?
It's going great.
Hey, I got a question in reference to iTunes. I'm the new guy on the block with this whole iTunes thing, and I'm using PCs. I don't have any Mac computers.
Okay.
One of the problems I'm having is sharing video in the shared library. I've been watching podcasts now for maybe just about 3 months, and all the smaller video podcasts I can connect to the main iTunes PC from my laptop with no problem. They play just fine.
Right.
But the other night I purchased a TV show and I could watch it on a PC. I downloaded it too, but I cannot watch it from a remote PC.
It keeps stopping.
And to give you a little bit, what's that?
It keeps stopping.
You'll see the play button
right.
go in for about 8 seconds
right.
and then release. I never get that connecting to URL message.
I think probably, are you using wireless? Of course you are.
Yes, I am.
Of course you are. And it's 802.11G?
No, it's the B. But,
okay, that's the problem.
Okay, to help troubleshoot a little bit of this.
There's no troubleshooting we need to do. That's the problem. The reason is
okay.
those TV shows are higher quality than the podcast mm-hmm. you're watching. The file size is much bigger, you probably noticed. Like we're talking 700 megabytes. And what happens... What happens is they're so big, there's so many bits per second, you can't stream them over B. Even G might be a little stymied. Sometimes you have to go to N, which is considerably faster. 802.11b really only gives you about 4 to 6 megabits if nothing else is going on. And that's not enough for those.
Okay.
That's all that's going on.
Now, if I had moved that video over to another PC and made it the shared library, and I was able to connect to it from the original one that I downloaded it on remotely, and that started streaming.
And you were able to watch it?
Just because of... Yeah, I was able to watch it. I mean, granted, it is a little choppy, but it did make that connection.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Well, see, that's the problem is it's going to be choppy. That's what's going to happen is it's going to start and stop. It may be that other PC is in a better position relative to the wireless mm-hmm. access point.
Okay.
So is it closer to the wireless access point?
Yes, it is a little bit closer.
That might be it. It might be it's a faster PC, which means it's getting more of it done. Then if you could connect to watch some video, you should be able to connect mm-hmm. to watch all video.
Yeah.
That shouldn't, it's not a firewall issue or, anything else like that. It might be a copy protection issue. That's the other thing is that if you have purchased programs, or rather music or video on the iTunes, if you purchase it from the iTunes music store, it's got copy protection on it. And you'll only be able to play it back on machines that you've logged into your iTunes account with. But you would know that because the first time you try to play it, it would say, this machine is not authorized to play this. Please log in. So I'm not thinking it's that. I think probably it's a speed issue more than anything else. And that's very common. I mean, if you were able to, the only difference is that you were able to watch unprotected video and it's protected videos is a problem. So it could be the copy protection. The other difference is that the file sizes. So it's one or the other. It's either that their files are just too dense. They're higher quality now. Much higher quality than most podcasts, but even higher quality than the old video Apple was selling. And so they're going to need a higher speed internet connection to get across that. And I think B is too slow. I really do. B's fast enough to stream music, barely, but it's usually not fast enough to do video. You're going to have to go to G, and I would say just skip G and go right to N. Carl, Toledo, Ohio, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yes, hi, Leo.
Hi,
how
Carl.
Are you today?
Great, how are you?
Yeah, I was listening to you and Steve Gibson the other day, and you were talking about hacks for the Kindle.
Yeah.
But you never gave a reference of where
Shame
to
on me.
We watch you, Leo. We listen to you.
I should have put that in the show notes, and I just forgot.
Figured you did.
It's a guy named Igorsk who reversed. It's really a neat story. It's Igorsk dot blogspot.com. That's his blog.
Okay.
And if you search in there for Kindle, you'll see he has several posts on the Kindle, one of which, what he did, the Kindle is Amazon's ebook reader.
Right,
and
I have one.
It's wonderful. And it's only been out a few months. He figured out a way to get into it as root, as the super user, download the ROM contents, the actual software that's running on it, and then disassembled it, which means he reverse engineered it. He actually looked at the what looks like a lot of gobbledygook, ran it through a disassembler, and actually looked at the code and was able to figure out what it does. And he came up with some wonderful hacks. He came up, for instance, there's a game in there called Minesweeper you can play.
Mm-hmm. I heard you say that.
Yeah, Steve
and
wanted
the
to
time.
The time. Yeah, Steve wanted to turn on the time.
Right. I tried that as I was listening.
Did
to
it work?
Works. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
Is that great?
Yeah, I have a hack.
Okay.
It's a very simple hack.
Yes.
When I bought mine, I was about ready to return it because of these levers being on both sides. It
drives me
and
crazy.
And I like to hold my book in my right hand.
Yeah.
I kept tripping the next page lever.
Me too. What, you got a fix for that?
Very easy one. You know these little bookmarks that you get in the mail that are made of plastic?
Stick it in there, huh?
You simply slide it in there, and it disables that switch, and it works great.
I've got to do that.
You can just reach in there with a little stylus and pull it out if you want to.
Right.
It doesn't disturb it at all. It's about the size of a 32-pound or 40-pound paper.
You just jam it.
And you just slide it in the whole length of it plastic.
Oh,
it was Time Life's bookmark.
Do you recommend that one? Is that, you think, the finest?
Yeah, I had the Sony one. I talked to you before.
Yes.
I had a Sony one, and the screen went bad.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and
that.
And I was so mad because they wouldn't cover nothing on
right.
it.
I'm
so,
loving the Kindle.
I bought the Kindle. I like it. The screen is much better, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think it's the same screen, but I think it's better because they have bigger and better fonts.
Yeah, I think the fonts is a little different, but it seemed like
better.
The contrast ratio is a little different.
Could be, yeah. It's the same company.
But, one thing I enjoy, I listen to you all the time on my iPod.
Thank you.
And one thing about you, Leo, you gather around you some of the smartest individuals
in this business. I agree. I give them all the credit, and I'm just very fortunate to be working with them.
And you know how to extract the information from them so everybody has a good time.
Well, Steve's easy. You just give him a five shot latte. That's what he drinks. It's a Quinti Venti latte is what he drinks.
And that young girl that you had on your show up in Canada,
Amber MacArthur.
Yeah, she's just a joy to listen to. Such a smart lady. I'm 65, and I said, boy, I wish that was my daughter.
I know. Isn't she great? No, I've been very, very fortunate to work with great people. And the thing is, I'm lazy. So I have to surround myself
you
with
can't,
good.
You can't be lazy, Leo, and put on as many podcasts as you do.
Carl, you're very kind. But I am lazy because I didn't put those show notes up. You know what? I will put those in the show notes. What we're going to do is put the link to that exact post that you want, the Hacking the Kindle post. We'll put that in our show notes, which is techguylabs.com. I just sent it off to Sasha. And there's a bunch of them. The one I like the best that's really actually useful, because it has a Sprint PCS built in, it's got a modem built in. You can't make phone calls. That's how you download the books in the Kindle. But if you go into the browser, which is in the settings menu in the experimental, you go to the browser. When you hit Alt-1 in the browser, it uses the Sprint PCS to figure out what cell site you're nearest, and it pinpoints you on Google Maps. It opens Google Maps with your location. If you hit Alt-2, it finds gas stations near you. Alt-3 finds restaurants near you. This isn't a book reader. Isn't that amazing? We'll put the link in the show notes. Hey, thanks for your kind words, Carl. I really appreciate it. More of your calls to come. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Tech Guy, 88, Ask Leo. Let's go to line 5 and say hi to Ann in Escondido, California. Hi, Ann. How are you today?
Oh, hi, Leo. Great.
Thanks for hanging
on. I had a question about, this is kind of elementary, I'm sure, for most people, but the pop-ups like Adobe Update or HP Update.
Oh,
and,
drive me crazy.
I'm wondering if, and also other things that come up, they'll say things like the website wants you to run the following add-ons, like Windows Media Player. Is there any danger in clicking any of these that it could
I'm so glad you're asking. Absolutely. But it depends on who it is asking. And so when you're sure it's Adobe and it's the Adobe Media Player, because really when you click OK, you're giving it permission to download something and put it on your system. So your instinct that there might be something bad here is absolutely right on. I'm really glad you had that instinct.
Well, how can you tell?
Well, that's a good question. Because, it's possible for a bad guy to pose as Adobe or Microsoft. But generally, you'll know it won't look the same. It will be more like an ad. But that's one of the things. You know, you'll be surfing along on the web. You don't have any spyware on your system. You don't have any bad guys, no malware, no Trojans. But you're just using your browser. You're surfing along, and there'll be a window will pop up saying, oh my God, you have a Trojan horse in your system. Immediately click this and download it. And in fact, that's a Trojan horse that they're trying to get you to download. Uh-huh. So you're okay. Right to worry about those. Now, when Adobe, you know, Adobe has, and it really annoys me, this Adobe updater that runs from time to time says, oh, you need to update Adobe. Yeah, that's, you know, that that you do, that's legit. But it drives me crazy because by doing that, they're in a way telling people it's okay to click these buttons and say, yes, download it.
And you can't hardly get off of it.
I know, it drives me crazy.
You really can't. And
no,
you end up having
I agree with
to,
you.
Do something.
In the case of Adobe, go ahead. That is something that does. You'll see HP puts their has special updating software on there. Yeah, it's fine. Except that I know that I live in fear that some bad guy is going to make one that looks exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to click it. Now, here's the deal. If you close your browser and it's still there, then chances are that's okay. Because it's running on a program, unless your system is infected. Once your system is infected, all bets are off.
If you're using the Nod 32 and the Defender, the
good,
then is it you're
no.
pretty safe?
No. The other thing, it's no guarantee of safety, and it's absolutely good thing to have. I'm not saying don't have it, but here's the problem: is that these things spread so fast they can outpace the ability of antiviruses and anti-spyware to catch up, and so there's a window of opportunity when you're vulnerable. So you should never rely on these as your sole line of defense. They're great for checking. And if you make sure that they update regularly, and I'm sure you do, then mm-hmm. if you catch something, eventually they'll notice it. Problem is, nowadays, sometimes they may notice it but not be able to remove it.
Right. But yeah, that information bar that popped up and it says the website wants to
that's,
run something like yeah. Windows Media Player. Is that dangerous?
No, that's good. When you see that, that's good. That's Explorer. And this is something they put in new in Internet Explorer to protect you. And this is a very good thing. It's Explorer in the past. Explorer would just install it, or it might give you a little box, but it would just basically go ahead and do it. And it was that was when I was saying, don't use Explorer no matter what. But now that they do thing, what they do is they by default, they don't install it. And they say, look, it's trying to install something. If you want us to install it, click the yellow bar. And that's a much better thing.
How would you know if it's safe to install something that says like Windows Media Player extension from Microsoft?
That's the problem. You have to see what site you're on, and you have to trust that site. Anytime you allow, that's whenever you see that yellow bar, it's coming from the site you're on saying, I want to install something. Only do it if you're on a site that is a mainstream known entity. You know, you really, it's Amazon, it's Microsoft. If you're on Microsoft's site and you get that bar, fine. If you go to YouTube or Google, fine. What they're saying is there. In order to display the content on this page, you need additional capabilities. We'd like to install that in your browser right now. And you need to do that if you want to see what's on that page. But that's also what bad guys would do. And in order to steal your password, we need to install a Trojan horse right now. Would you like us to? I wish they would say I wish they would say that. They don't.
So, exactly.
But that's the problem. People like Steve Gibson, the security, you know, he's ultra paranoid security guy. He's going to say never install anything.
Oh.
But, you know, he says turn off all scripting. But then you can't use the net.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm a more middle of the road guy. I say, yeah, just be very cautious. It's good that you have Nod 32 and Defender. Those are the two programs I would recommend. Nod 32 for antivirus. It has some anti-spyware as well. Defender for anti-spyware. Those two together are an excellent combination on Windows, and they will usually, after the fact, at least let you know. They'll give you some sense that I'm pretty safe. You know what? The truth is, you're all right, Anne. Do you have teenage kids?
No.
That's who will get you in trouble. Because they go, whatever. I want to download that file. Come on. Yeah, get going. And they click. And that's when, I'll tell you, every person I know who has Windows and a teenage kid has a virus or a spyware or a Trojan.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
I don't let my kids use Windows. they're on Macs. And they're locked down. They're on lockdown Macs. Because, they're teenagers. And what are they going to, they're not going to.
Get them on a Mac, I guess.
Yeah. But Ann, you're probably okay. What I sense is a good sense of prudence, and that's what's going to protect you. Just be, you know, if you have a bad feeling about it, don't do it. It's like going down a dark alley. Just don't do it. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy.
Carbonite Automatic Secure Computer Backup over the Internet. Try it free at Carbonite.com.
Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Ron Rosberg's on the line right now. He's the gadget guru. Joins us every week at this time to talk about gadgets. And Ron went to Vegas. I think you'll use any excuse to go to Vegas, Ron. Yeah, sure, why not? Well, that's the best, you know, those are the people, you and I don't gamble either. You and I are the people who should go to Vegas because we can enjoy the... they see us coming. So PMA is the Photo Marketing Association. They do a big show every year, and this is really the place now where digital cameras come to shine.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you were talking a little bit ago with the
we talked to Mikkel, yeah.
Now, yeah, who wrote all those wonderful books.
He does high-end.
I know.
And I knew what you were going to do.
Leo, the cameras I chose here right now, by the way, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them until I actually get them physically in my hands,
okay. Which
hopefully will be in the next 60 to 90 days. But I just want to give the audience a taste of some cameras that came out. Actually, the Casio, the first one I'm talking about, came out actually at CES. They showed it at CES, and got a tremendous site. Tom's Hardware, which is a wonderful site for years and years and years, has a video with the Casio rep on it, who really goes in and demonstrates the camera, and you could see this thing. But what this camera is going to sell for $1,000. It's going to be out in about April. It blasts out 1,200 frames per second on video, and
so it's like you could do super slow-mo.
Yeah, but also it's more famous for its still. Okay, the still on it is going to be phenomenal. It's going to be shoot as soon as you touch. You know how most cameras you put your finger down halfway and it autofocuses.
Yeah.
It actually is taking about 60. I think it's 60 frames per second, Leo, of still. Okay, and it is. I can't tell you enough about it in the short time I have. So if you go to the show notes, and again, I say we've got the best show notes of anybody up there, and Sasha does a great job. If you click on the Casio, you'll want to see a video demonstration of this camera. Now, this is no changeable lenses on this camera. This camera is going to have, it's a 6 megapixel. And as you heard, I also believe the same thing. We're getting into this overkill with 12 and 15 and 20 megapixel stuff. 6 and 8 are plenty.
Well, especially in a compact camera.
Well, unless you're just a horrible photographer and all your pictures you're taking left of center or right of center, and you need more pixels.
You have to crop them. Yeah.
And the nice thing about this camera is you'll be able to take the pictures. And then now what you'll do is you'll go into the camera, and it will show you each of those pictures, and now you select the one you want. Okay,
so each second you've got 60 pictures. That's
exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's the fastest burst on anything out there.
How long does that go? I mean, you can't go forever at 60 frames a second.
So I was kidding around last night. They said, "What's the battery life?" I said, 7 seconds.
But you got 420 pictures.
Right.
So
right.
I mean, I can't go 60 pictures a second for an infinite amount of time.
Look, this is for moms and pops out at a soccer game with their kids, right?
Yeah.
How many people, you know, the kid already kicks the ball, Leo,
right?
And you already missed that shot,
right?
So this is going to save you that to do that, okay? This is going to be, you know, again, it's not a.
Did you get a sense of how many seconds it can shoot at that rate for?
No, but you'll go on and take a look at the demonstration. It will give you a lot.
Tom's Hardware has a great video of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great video on the thing, I think it's like runs like either a 5-minute video, so you'll really get a lot out of it.
Well, and the other thing that's cool is because it can shoot video at 1,200 frames a second, that means you could do super slow-mo.
Right.
Like they do on the football games.
Right.
Which would be very cool.
And by the way, the 60 frames per second, it was at full screen and stuff, too.
Yeah,
so
it's
really, you know, again, when I get one of these and I could talk about it more, I'll be doing it. The next one is by Olympus. And Olympus has the 20X. Now, this is a step up from their model that before, but there's a 20X, and it's got a ring around it. Instead of, you know, most of these digital cameras, these smaller ones, this is not a pocket size either, but they normally have a little lever, a control bar that you use to go left and right. Now, the more expensive ones, like the one you have and stuff like that, they use a ring to zoom in, and it's much better on the ring. And they've incorporated the ring on this camera.
Oh, that's
this
neat.
Camera. This camera also, and they say this is going to be for the paparazzis because it's 20x, Leo. 20x is pretty damn good on a
20x zoom. Wow.
Yeah. And so yeah, this is the 20x zoom camera. And this will also be out, I believe this is going to also come out in April by Olympus. So take a look at we'd send you right over to the site. You can take a look at that one.
This is it feels and looks like an SLR with that, especially with that zoom ring, but it's just one lens. You can't change lenses.
That's right. And the same thing with the Casio. They are cameras and stuff. And the last one is an update on the Canon Digital Rebel, Leo. It's the XSI. Street price is going to be, and this, by the way, this camera sells, I think, for $1,799 is the street price on it.
This replaces their very popular, probably the most popular low end.
Yeah, the Digital Rebel has been great. It's got a 3-inch LCD screen. It's got self-cleaning sensors, which you find on the more expensive cameras. It's got a 9-point autofocus system, 3.5 frames per second. And it uses the SD and SDHC. Now, the HC stands for high capacity. I will mention this. I meant to put this on the site. Kingston also showed at PMA a 16-gig high-capacity SD card, Leo. It's around $220.
Wow.
So that's going to be available shortly, too. And you're going to need this, especially if you're talking how many people want to shoot RAW. You know, if you're shooting RAW, you're going to need high-capacity cards and stuff. So a 16-gig SD card is pretty good. And that's by Kingston. I don't have the link on there, but you can go to their website. The last thing I want to talk about, Leo, this thing has got me so excited. I heard about this last week, and I said, I got to call them. You know, I didn't get the iPhone. I got a Touch. And what I love about the Touch, it's got Wi-Fi on it. The problem is, I've been running around in my car with the Kyocera KR1, which is a big box, for EVDO to plug my EVDO USB card in there, adapter, should say. And so I have a big battery that I bought at Costco for about $80 that, you know, you jump start cars with. And that's what I'm using to run this thing off of. But I heard about this Cradle Point. Leo, this is a size of about a king-size package of cigarettes. I don't smoke. Maybe a little larger than that. And listen to this. It's battery-operated or AC. It comes with the AC adapter. They make two models of this piece. This gives you your own personal hotspot, Leo. It works like this. You turn it on. Make sure you have, you could, now the two models, I'll tell you about one model first would be for Sprint. They're both the same. They look identical. One will be made for Sprint. It's going to be available March 1st. So if you're a Sprint customer and you already have a broadband card a USB adapter and you're paying $59.95 a month, you'll want to get one of these. It's $140 available March 1st. That's just in about 2 weeks. And plug your USB into that. And wherever you are, I keep this in my Scotty vest, just on the inside pocket. It's very lightweight. And now I pick up my Touch and I go over and I want to see the stock market or you know, which I've got on the Touch, and I've got weather, and the Safari browser is pretty neat, you know, because I could blow it up with my fingers and stuff and really take a look at the text. I can get my email on it. And then the other, that's called the PHS 300S, $139 or $140. And then if you have a Verizon or AT&T USB broadband, and Novatel makes a real good one. It's one of my favorites. The PHS 300C is $179, and that's available today. You can go buy that online right now from cradlepoint.com. And this is just one of the coolest items. And by the way, if you're at a meeting, like you said you were at Macworld, right?
Right.
Okay, and you turn this on. On the Sprint one, you could have five people also join you on your internet. You can make it secure if you want, or non-secure. If you get the PHS 300C, I think it's up to 14 people. Now, granted, if you have 14 people downloading movies on it, forget it. It's going to be a little on the slow side. But I've had this now for 3 or 4 days, and I am just so enthusiastic about it.
So the idea is you already own a USB card, an EVDO card from Sprint or from Verizon. You plug it into this thing. It knows how to talk to the card and turns it into...
By the way, Leo, no drivers, no software needed on this thing at all. You don't have to put any software. It automatically goes on. Now, by the way, if you don't have a card, remember I talked about the 720 by Novatel. The 720 card is available for $49.95 from either Verizon or from Sprint. So, Leo, for under $200... for $200, you can have your own, you can go to Starbucks, reach into your pocket or your purse and turn this thing on, and you could either use it on your computer if you want. If you have some other friends, they could share it with you. And no looking for high spots anymore. Just create your own, battery powered for true portability. And third party testing that they did on this, Leo, they actually got 20% above what even Sprint had claimed. And also, neat thing too, the USB-A port can even charge your phone. So it has two USBs, one for going in with your USB adapter, and then you also have a regular USB, so you could charge your phone on that. And it has built-in firewall and WPA encryption. I just love it. I can't talk enough about it. And no, I'm not getting paid from them. I didn't get a check yet.
All right. Ron Rosberg, the Gadget Guru. Thanks for joining us, Ron. Your PMA update, some very cool stuff. And Ron joins us every hour, every week, not every hour, every week at this time to talk about it. And we have all the details on our show notes, techguylabs.com. Tony in. Okay, Tony, you're going to have to help me on this. Gallup Louise?
You got it right. Gallup Louise.
And where is Gallup Louise?
It's actually about 100 miles from Columbus, but it's right across the river from West Virginia.
I got it. Gallup Louise. It's in Ohio.
Right on the Ohio River.
Sounds beautiful.
It is. It was the first settlement by the French when they came down the Ohio River. And Gallup Louise is French for City of the Gulls. We don't have any gulls. We have a lot of sparrows, but no gulls.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
Well, what can I do for you, Tony?
Well, it's an honor talking to you, first of all.
My pleasure talking to you.
I used to watch you on Tech TV many years ago.
Oh, yeah. The good old days. Long gone now. It's been 4 years.
Well, I get you on TiVo now my TV.
Oh, good.
On your webcast, on your podcast.
Yeah, I was pleased to see that TiVo was featuring us on that. That's nice.
Oh, it's wonderful. It just downloads it right to my TV, and I just sit there and watch it. And every time you have one, I watch it.
All right, we got 30 seconds, so let me get the question, and then we'll put you on hold while we take a break, and I'll come back and answer it.
Okay, the question is, I have an old laptop. The battery died about a year ago, and I wasn't going to use it anymore, but I've decided to go ahead and use it on the front porch and just use it with electricity.
Oh, we're running out of time. I'll tell you what, let's take a break. We'll come back. It's my fault. I asked you about Gallup Louise. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo's the number, 888-827-5536. A couple of people have already mentioned it, but this show and many other shows that I do, this show is on the internet, but I also do a dozen other internet-only shows, and you can hear them all on my Netcast network. That's twit.tv, twit.tv, stands for This Week in Tech. You can also just go to iTunes. And go to the iTunes Music Store. I know they call it the store, but they're free. Click the podcast link in the iTunes Music Store. And over on the left, they have a list of providers, you know, NBC, NPR, The Onion, and I'm one of them, twit.tv. You click that, you'll see all the shows. You can subscribe to any of them absolutely free. Most of them are weekly. Some of them are daily. And, of course, this is twice weekly. So you can hear the show. If you miss it, you can hear the show on twit.tv or iTunes. Now, back to Tony. In Gallup Louise, but I'm not going to say that again. I'm not going to get in that conversation again. We're going to find out what's wrong with Tony's battery. So you had a battery, an old laptop battery that died.
Yes. So I decided that I would use the laptop on the front porch and just use the AC.
All right.
So I plug it in. It runs for about 15 minutes and then just dies.
With nothing in it at all?
Nothing. Well, the battery's still in there.
I try popping out the battery. If a battery's bad...
Uh-huh.
Sometimes the computer won't charge with the battery in. It won't run with the battery in. It tries to run through the battery, in other words. So pull the battery and see if it operates normally in that case. Now, it's weird because you've got a little hole in the computer.
Yeah.
But that's often the case. In fact, sometimes if a battery's dead, you can't even charge the computer at all.
Okay.
You can't even use it. So try taking that out and see if that fixes it.
Now, it gets very warm, so I'm wondering if the fan could be having some problem with it.
Could be. Did it? Has it? I mean, it's an older computer. Did it get warm when you first got it?
No.
Okay. Yeah, no. that could well be, and it could be in fact related to why it's shutting down after 15 minutes. You're right. I'd try pulling the battery anyway.
Okay.
The warm could be the fan stopped working, or you know, it's got a little dust in there and it's acting like a blanket and it's keeping the fan from being effective.
Uh-huh.
That's probably not something you want to try to fix yourself. Opening a laptop is a dicey business. Sometimes hard to get back together. It's like when I was a kid, I used to take apart watches. I could never get them back together again. This is opening a laptop. Very similar experience. What is this? Okay. What is this part? Where did this go? So I would suggest having an expert do that. They could probably blow it out. Again, if it's really old, it may not be worth spending any money on, but
yeah,
you know, keep the old BESS alive. Now, if it's just overheating, you can keep it cooler by getting an inexpensive USB-based laptop. You don't have to. You can have a passive one that's just a little laptop desk, kind of. It's a riser. Keeps more air underneath it. Especially if you're sitting within your lap, that's kind of insulating the bottom. The other thing you can do is they make some that plug into the USB port and have little fans in the bottom. And I've tested them. We did some tests with a thermal probe, and it actually found out that reduced it about 10 degrees centigrade, quite a bit.
Yeah,
you can find them on eBay for $5-$10. They're not very expensive. They're just plexiglass laptop stands with two fans. You plug them into the USB port. Since you're AC anyway, you don't mind that it's using up a little bit of the juice, and it'll keep it much, much cooler. Maybe, and that may help.
Very good.
All right, Tom.
Thank you so much.
It sounds very pleasant sitting on the porch. Can you see the river?
Oh, it is. It's a beautiful little town.
Oh, it
wonderful. Really is.
Sounds all America. Very, very Americana. Have fun with except for the laptop. That's a little more modern. I don't think Mark Twain had the laptop. Mike in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Mike. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
I've got a HP Pavilion laptop I bought at the end of 2001, right after XP came out, and that was loaded in it. I've used it sporadically over the years, and I'm not real technical on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm having a problem when I turn it on, it doesn't want to, the start screen comes on, but before it hits the Windows, it goes to a black screen with some characters up top, and it won't go past
there. Yeah.
Sometimes I can get it out with Control Alt Delete, hit that number of times. Sometimes it comes on, sometimes it doesn't.
It's probably the hard drive starting to feel its age.
Well, I took it to someone, and they said it could be the hard drive, it could be this, et cetera, et cetera. I did the diagnostics on it, and I hit the F10, and it comes up update BIOS, and BIOS ROM test failed.
Oh, okay.
It says update BIOS or the notebook system board.
Yeah, I think what's probably happened is that there's a part of the computer that is non-volatile. When you turn it off, the memory stays there, and it keeps information about your settings and so forth, including your system time. And that thing's 6 years, 7 years old now. So after a while, that battery that's backing that thing up doesn't work anymore.
Okay.
It may be
okay.
replaceable. It isn't on all laptops, but it may be replaceable. That's an inexpensive thing to do. Just the labor, pretty much. The battery itself is a couple of bucks. That would give you that error message.
Okay.
That it because the settings are confused. It says, redo the CMOS or change the BIOS. You could try, look and see if you could find the manufacturer's website, and you might be able to download an updated BIOS, but I don't think that's going to fix it. What I wouldn't do is spend any money on it at this point, because it's...
Okay, right. Well, I never did any of the service packs or anything on this.
Oh, boy.
Is that worth doing, or
if it were mine and you wanted... And, you know, I mean, look, it still runs. Wanted to keep using it... Well, Cordis sort of still runs. What I'd probably do is do you still have the disks that came with it, the install disks?
I have everything with it, right.
All right, good news. You can reinstall all that stuff, see if that fixes it. If it's a hard drive error, that doing that with a format may well fix all of that.
Okay.
The good news is Microsoft is coming out with Service Pack 3 for XP probably in the next month. And at that point, that is every update that you've missed since that laptop was shipped. So that's good news. It means I would be very careful about going online with it until you add these patches, because it's an unpatched virgin XP. You go on the internet and you will, within a minute or two, you will contract you know, Sasser, Zotop. In fact, you may have Sasser now. That's a worm that forces it to reboot every 30 seconds. So, and those things are endemic on the net. And because you don't have any of the patches since XP came out, there's hundreds of exploits that you're vulnerable to.
So is the XP3, is that going to be a disk that you buy?
No, it'll be free from Microsoft. You'll be able to download it as part of Windows Update. So keep your eye peeled for that. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. We're talking high tech with you. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my phone number. Chris Marquardt is coming up. This turned into photo day. I didn't plan it that way. And I guess that's the problem. I didn't plan it. But we are going to talk to Chris Marquardt. He has some tips on digital photography coming up a little later on this hour. But mostly it's all about your calls at 8888-ASK-LEO. Well, there's lots to talk about. This Yahoo Microsoft deal. Microsoft putting in a very, I think, generous bid for Yahoo. 61%, was it? I think it was something like that. 30, certainly significantly over the stock price. Offering them $44.6 billion for the company. The latest, Yahoo's board of directors says, no, we want more. They want $12 billion more. And maybe they are worth it. They told the Wall Street Journal, we're undervalued right now. The stock market's low. We think we're worth more than that. Of course, this is a company in big trouble, Yahoo. In fact, it's expected that no matter what happens, whether this purchase goes through or not, that many, many of its employees will be laid off. A lot of bad investments over the years haven't panned out. Most famously, buying Broadcast.com for billions of dollars from Mark Cuban and then shutting it down. We'll see what happens. I completely understand their desire, Yahoo's desire to hold on to the company, to not be subsumed by Microsoft. Microsoft's such a big company. The Yahoo corporate culture would go away. A lot of Yahoo employees would go away. It would change the company thoroughly. And Jerry Yang, David Filo and Jerry Yang founded it when they were graduate students at Stanford. And Jerry says, it's always my goal to run this company for the rest of my life. This is what I want to do. This is my life's work. I don't want to sell it. And imagine, I mean, no matter what your business is, somebody comes along and says, we want to buy the business. You won't have a place in it. You know, we'll run it. That's a tough thing to say yes to, even if they offer you a lot more than it's worth. Apparently, Jerry doesn't think it's a lot more than it's worth. How would you feel? Let's say you have a shoe store. And business is good. You're enjoying your work. Maybe it's not great. Maybe the recession's hurting you a little bit. Somebody, Kinney's Shoes comes along and says, we like your shoe store. We like your location. We'd like to put a Kinney's here. We'd like to buy it from you. We're going to pay you twice what it's worth. But you have to walk away tomorrow. That's a tough decision. I guess it's tougher because Jerry already has enough money, right? It's not like he can't spend all the money he has already. So the money isn't much of an incentive for him. Now, it might be for the stockholders who are looking at their stock saying, boy, this isn't worth very much. And I think for Microsoft, it's an interesting thing. You know, some people say, well, and I'm one of them who says, well, you know, this is very different from Microsoft's core business. This is Microsoft saying we want to try a new business. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe Microsoft's kind of on the end of the curve. Maybe it's time for Microsoft to start thinking differently about itself. The idea of selling software is really changing. With what we call cloud computing, using software on the internet, Microsoft Office isn't as valuable anymore with Google offering its own free online office. And I think Microsoft eyes Yahoo and says, well, we could kind of get into that business. And oh, by the way, we'd also have a juggernaut in online email. They'd be, you know, bigger than anybody by far. We'd have a juggernaut in online advertising. We'd be big in search. Maybe we should do that. You know, if you're diversifying, if you're trying to reinvent Microsoft, maybe this is the right way to go. And if Yahoo says no, now what do they do? Is it worth another $12 billion? Is Yahoo worth $56 billion? I don't think so. I don't think Microsoft has the money or the will to do it. Be interesting if it turns hostile. Microsoft says, well, all right. And goes to the shareholders and says, look, we're offering you a lot of money. Why don't you oust that board of directors and accept the deal? And they could do it. Now, that's when it gets interesting. That's when it gets fun. We could talk about that. Anything on your mind, problems with your computer, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, home theater, want to know how to buy your next TV, want to know what the digital transition is going to mean to you, 888-ASK-LEO. That's my number, 888-827-5536. Stoney's in Mayfield, Kentucky. Hi, Stoney.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, great. Longtime fan.
Thank you.
Glad to talk to you. Goes all the way back to the old screensaver days, actually.
So, is Mayfield anywhere near Louisville?
Actually, it is all the way out in the western end of the state. A lot closer to Nashville and St. Louis and Memphis, all the way out.
We made early on in Tech TV, we made some appearances. Louisville was incredible. But we also went to St. Louis and we went to Nashville. So a great part of the country, and we had a lot of fans there. I tell you, I miss it.
Yeah, it really is. I've got you on the XM, and I said, I do your podcast and everything else too.
Thank you, Stoney. Thank you.
Question I had here, and this is just it popped up recently, and I actually went back and rebooted my entire took my desktop. It's about a year old. Took it back to the original state because I thought I'd gotten a virus.
That's not a bad thing to do. I know it's a pain and it takes a weekend and you got to back up everything, but it's you come out with a nice fresh machine.
Yeah, I did. It certainly helped speed up the process. That's for sure.
Yeah,
but it didn't fix the problem.
Uh-oh.
The problem, and it's not a huge thing, but when I go in, I've got some AVI files in some places in yonder, a folder with my videos or, and anything from my camcorders and different stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an AVI file in there and I click on the AVI file, it's the default is set to open Windows Media Player.
Right.
And when it does that, then I get a DEP error screen comes up, a data encryption error. Data execution.
Okay.
Convention.
Yeah.
But then it'll shut down the player, and then it takes it all the way back, and then it takes just a second, but then just takes Windows Explorer everything else off of the desktop.
Yeah, you've got data execution prevention turned on for some reason.
Yeah, and I don't know how to turn it off. That's the whole thing, and it didn't always do this, but
that's strange that it would survive over a rebuild. Because it's a setting.
I can go in and open a separate DivX player that I've got on there and open it and then go find that file. And it'll play fine.
Yeah. Here's what it is. This is actually a really, you're running XP Service Pack 2 probably, yes?
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. Pro.
This is a really, I think, a good idea, but it does cause some programs to crash, and Windows Media Player is one of them. So the idea is one of the reasons Windows is insecure, and actually any system would be insecure, is because it allows the operating system can run a program out of a data area.
Okay.
Now, if you say to the computer, no, you can only run programs if they're in a program area, that keeps a lot of the hacks away. A lot of hacks take advantage of the fact that you can trick the program to jumping to a part of a program in a data area and running that. In fact, that's how all these buffer overflow problems, that's how they work. That's how these exploits work.
Okay.
If you turn off DEP, if you turn on DEP, if you say, sorry, Windows, you may not run a program that's in a data area. You may only run programs that are in program areas. That actually makes this machine many times more secure. But sometimes programs are written for various reasons to run programs out of the data area, and you've got one. So here's what you do. You open the control panel, the system control panel, and you go to the advanced tab. This is in the performance settings.
Oh, okay.
And there is, the easiest way to do this is to right-click on my computer. That'll open the system control panel. It goes right directly to the system control panel if you select properties. And then you're going to go to the advanced system settings, and you're going to disable, under the performance, you're going to disable data execution prevention.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Now, see if that fixes it. That's the error you're getting, and that's commensurate with what I believe is the case, which is that DEP will crash a media player.
Oh, okay.
And Divi- the reason it doesn't crash the DivX player is because the DivX player is written properly. It doesn't. There's reasons programmers do this. Sometimes they want to have code that will change on the fly, so they'll move, it's data for them to put code in the data, and then you say, okay, execute that. But it's also what hackers use. So, for instance, I'll give you an example of how this would happen. If a common buffer overflow is in the browser, where you have a browser string, you enter in a URL that's too long, and the browser doesn't check it, and the stuff that's extra long gets actually stuck into data memory, and you trick the browser into executing it, and it turns out that's a program the hacker put on there to take over your system. So DEP is a good thing.
I have the XP home on my laptop, which I carry around, plus I also put on my network that I have in my home, and it never does it. It works just fine.
Turned off.
Yeah.
I believe it is only professional, and it is as Service Pack 2 by default in Service Pack 2. So I think that's probably what's going on. Turn it off. You notice I'm always making recommendations on how to secure your system, and I don't mention that setting. While that really is a really good setting, it unfortunately does cause enough problems with software, like Windows Media Player 11, that it's probably not a good idea to turn it on. Other programs, and oddly enough, many of the Microsoft programs don't work with DEP turned on. This is something that's built into the chip. The hardware can do it. And all you're doing in when you click that box is you're telling the hardware, okay, enforce this. And when it does, boom, crash. Too bad, because it's a really good technique. I wish we could use it. And the future operating systems are sure will. The software just needs to be rewritten not to do that. Not to execute data programs in the data area. Denise Downey, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I shouldn't have picked you up because we got to take a break, but I'll pick you up right after these important messages. Okay, Denise? Don't go anywhere. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Board, the tech guy. Well, we're having a little chat about data execution prevention in the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com. And both Dan and XP99 are big fat know-it-alls say, oh no, turn it on. I have it on all my machines, never have any problems. So, and they're right. It's certainly better to run it if you can. It's on by default in Vista. It's on by default, I believe, in XP Service Pack 2. But if you go to the performance options in the system property control panel, in Vista, you'll go system properties, advanced, performance options, data execution prevention. There are two choices in Vista. You could turn it on for essential Windows programs and services only, or for all programs and services, and then you can even add exemptions. Now, in order for this to work, your computer has to support it in the chip, but any Vista machine probably does. Certainly all the new chips do. And if you had a problem with a particular program, you could just add that program. It certainly would be safer to do that. But I have resisted mentioning this as a, you know, kind of default security procedure, because generally if you don't have it turned on, there's a reason. If you have a system where it's not turned on, either it doesn't support it, or it's an older operating system, or for whatever reason it's not working. You know, if HP ships you a computer with it turned off, there's probably a good reason. And what I don't want to do is get on the air. But Dan in XP99 said, no, it's okay. So what I'm going to say is everybody turn it on. And if you have a problem, you just call Dan or XP99, and they'll take care of it for you. How about that? Now let's get back to Denise. Sorry, Denise. I wasn't paying attention. Thank you for holding on. What can I do for you today?
I have a laptop, and everything is sideways.
Everything is sideways?
Yes.
Wait. This is great. Okay, so I mean, it's not great for you. Okay, so when you came home with the laptop, was it sideways, or is it just something that started recently?
That just started recently.
And when you say sideways, what do you mean? You mean that the left hand, what would normally be the left hand side of the screen, is at the top of the screen?
Yeah, you know how.
Everything.
I don't know how to explain it. Just sideways.
Is everything sideways, or just is your taskbar on the left or the right?
The taskbar is on the right.
Okay.
And it used to be along the bottom.
All right. Well. If this were a desktop, I would say, oh, no, you know, of course, because desktop computers are designed so that you can pivot your screen and you can operate it in portrait or landscape. Normally, where it's the wide screen, that's called landscape mode. And if you turn it sideways, it's portrait mode, where it's taller from top to bottom. And, you know, that's useful for web pages and text editing, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's odd that a laptop would be doing that.
Yeah, one day I turned it on, and I left the room for a minute, and my cat was sitting on it.
Oh, your cat did this. Okay. So I know what's going on here. There, you could turn this off with a command keystroke. You ready? Are you going to write this down? You want to hit Control Alt Up key.
Right. Say that again.
So you hold the Control key and the Alt key down.
Okay.
Or is it the Shift? I'm trying to remember. I think it's controlled alt and the arrow key. So you hold the control key and the alt key down. And then you press the up arrow or the down arrow.
Oh, okay.
And that's what happened is the cat mashed those just right. And she rotated everything.
She did.
Yeah. Bad cat. Cats are always, I don't know why it is. Cats love keyboards. What is that?
I don't know what that is, but it's funny.
I mean, when they say kitten on the keys, they're not kidding. They really love keyboards.
They do, especially my little girl. I think she gets mad when I get on the computer.
Sure, because she sees mom on there, and she says, I want to do that. That looks like fun. Now, kids will put a peanut butter sandwich in the CD drawer, so that's a little worse than what a cat can do. So Sasha's telling me in the chat room that the Intel graphics chipsets they use on laptops can also allow this rotation. Although it makes no sense on a laptop because you're not going to rotate the screen. The keyboard would be off to the side. It makes sense on a desktop. Anyway, Control, Alt, Up arrow or Down arrow will do it. I should do it on, let's see if it's going to do this on my system. That'll fix it. I love it. The case of the sideways screen. Matthew in New York, New York. Hello, Matthew. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
What can I do for you today?
I got a quick question for you. My friend and I, we love Twit and we love MacBreak.
Thank you.
We wanted to start up our own podcast.
Yeah.
And my question for you is what does the beginner's podcast studio look like? You know, what goes into the bare minimum?
Well, it kind of depends on how much money you have. But really, that's the beauty of podcasting is all you really need is a computer. Now, if you've got a couple of people, and it sounds, how many people are on the podcast?
It's going to be about 3 to 4.
Yeah, see, that's when it gets complicated. If it's just one person, you just plug a microphone into the computer, you're done. When you get a bunch of people, you either share a mic, depends how close you are to your buddies. Yeah, you could all sit around it or hand it around. But generally, I think what you're going to want to do is get a little mixer of some kind that allows you to put multiple microphones into it. There's a podcaster's kit from Behringer that's probably the best way to go. It's very inexpensive, Behringer. It's a podcast. They call it the Podcast Studio Complete. You can get it at Zsounds, Zsounds.com. A lot of other people sell it. It's under $200. It's got one microphone. You'll have to buy a couple more and a little baby mixer. And then you're set. Hey, coming up, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy. He's got some tips for you. More of your calls, too. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And we're going to get back to your calls in just a minute. We have another half hour to go in the show. But before we wrap up with your calls, I want to get Mr. Chris Marquardt on. He hasn't been on in an age, and I've been going through withdrawal. Chris Marquardt is a digital photographer, the host of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast at tipsfromthetopfloor.com. He also hosts workshops. In fact, he's coming back to the States in August to do some workshops. So we look forward to that. He's currently based in Tübingen, Germany. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Leo. It's so good to be back.
I apologize. I've been, traveling so much we haven't been able to talk, but I'm glad we could get you on and catch up. I've been having so much fun. I'm going on I'm really excited. I'm going on a photo expedition.
Wow.
I was invited by a friend who's a very good photographer, and I credit you because I think my photography has gotten better thanks to your assignments and your tips. But we're going to do a photo expedition in Tasmania, which is southern Australia, in the spring.
Fun.
Yeah, I can't wait. Actually, it'd be their fall, but I can't wait. It's going to be really fun. And
okay, remind before you go, I'll have a special assignment for you ready.
Just for that? Good. That'd be great.
Just for that.
And I have so many questions, but I'll save them for your podcast because I've been asking a lot of questions lately on your podcast. But at some point, maybe we could talk on this show about a kit, about what you should bring on something like that, because I'd like to think about what I need to bring along. But today we're going to do Chris alternates back and forth between, he does one creative one and then one technical one. Today's creative day.
Yeah, we try to alternate. Last show when I was on, actually, we gave out the lines assignment.
Yes, and I've been struggling with that.
and I promised to also talk a bit about lines in image composition, lines as a design element.
Right. I actually did a little photo walk today, looking for lines, and I didn't find anything I really liked. But I saw some stuff there. If you start looking for them, there are lines everywhere.
Exactly. That's a fun thing. We talked about all sorts of different design principles, by the way, in the past here on the show, the rule of thirds. I think that's months and months ago.
Yeah.
To reduce and simplify, to change the perspective of something, a framing element. We had all these, but one of the things that all these have in common that you can really make use of is if you look at a scene and try to form an abstract picture of the scene that you see, simplified in your mind. So I want you to do a quick exercise with me, Leo.
Okay.
Close your eyes.
All right.
And for anyone out there, if you're not driving a car, do that too.
Don't. If you're driving, don't do that. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just close your eyes, blank your mind, and then open your eyes and look out for lines around you.
Oh, there's tons everywhere. Frames, lines, squares. I mean,
what makes up lines? There are so many different types of lines where walls meet, or in general where surfaces meet.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a line on the road. You can have straight lines, curved lines, edges of things make lines.
Yeah.
A river, a pathway makes lines. Actually, you have a very good example right next to you, Leo. You have that. I'm pretty sure you have a music mixer.
Yes,
mixing board
I do.
With tons of knobs on it and faders and stuff. Connect the dots. There are tons of lines on
there
that
are.
Even.
It's very linear, actually. Yeah.
And there are even invisible lines.
What do you mean invisible? If you can't see them, how do you know they're there?
If you look at things that have eyes, a camera, a car, a person, an animal, where they look, that'll form a line.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
A virtual sort of line that's not actually there, but that feels like a line for you. Now, main question is, how do we use lines? What do we use them for?
Mm-hmm.
And there are different things that you can use lines for in pictures. The obvious thing is the line divides the picture
right
into different parts. Very easy. But more important, and that is kind of the key, how to effectively use lines is they can lead the eye of the viewer.
Yes.
And they can lead the eye of the viewer, let's say, from one part of a picture into another.
Right.
They can lead you into the picture. They can lead you out of the picture.
That's one thing I've learned from you absolutely is that not only does every picture have a subject, the first thing you see, but that a good composition then leads your eye around the picture.
Around the picture, or it has let's say, a fake subject, something that sticks out but is not the actual subject.
Right.
And then it has sort of a line that leads you to the subject.
Right. Painters do that, too. When they make a good painting, it leads your eye. And lines are very effective for that. Just ask Rauschenberg or who did
ask it? Rembrandt.
Rembrandt. Any great painter.
Yeah. Now, the next thing, again, if lines lead to a subject, that is much stronger than if lines lead just somewhere and end up not leading you anywhere. Our eyes tend to follow the lines. Perspective lines work really well. If you have, let's say, railroad tracks, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Those are perfect leading lines. And if at the end of this, where those lines almost meet, if there's a train coming towards you, that might be dangerous to take that
picture. But it's dramatic.
Yes. But that is certainly lines leading up to a subject.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the direction of lines is also important. We, in our Western culture, we are conditioned towards a certain preferred direction.
Yeah.
Guess what that is? It's left to right.
Yeah, because of reading. Yeah, and of course,
it's a reading direction.
In Arabic countries, it would be right to left.
Yeah, most likely. If you look at anything, stock charts, stuff like that, left to right, that's our direction. So if a line leads from the left to the right, that feels more at home.
Yeah.
Feels more well-rounded than if the line leads from right to left.
So should I try in my compositions to lead people's eyes from left to right, or is it kind of fun to do it the other way?
what I'm telling you here is it's not a right or a wrong. It's more to make you aware that these things are there, and you can actually create tension in a picture by leading downwards left or something, as opposed to upwards right, which feels more positive.
Right. Downwards left.
So you can use these things to your advantage.
Yeah. As long as you're aware of them.
Yes.
That's the key. You've got to be aware of it.
Yep.
How cool. How very interesting. As always, you make me want to run out and take a picture.
Go and do it.
And it's true. You know, it's funny that you should bring this up because, as I said, I did a little photo walk this morning and I saw lines everywhere.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right. This is an easy assignment. Do you want to participate in our assignment? Please do. We'd love to have you. It's free. It's easy. Here's how you do it. You have to have a Flickr or Yahoo account. You log in to flickr.com. It's free and easy to create an account, of course. Once you have a Flickr account, just pick your line. I've been saying lines. It's actually line singular is the assignment. Pick your picture that illustrates a line. It doesn't have to be a physical line. It could be anything that means to you. Right?
The concept of line.
Concept of line. Upload it, tag it with line, and then you'll need to join the Tech Guy group. That's easy to do. Right on the Flickr front page or any of Flickr page, you'll see a groups menu item at the top there. Click it, and you can search for Tech Guy. You'll find our group. Join it. It's free. It's easy. Once you're a member of the group, then you can put a copy of your picture in the group. One picture per week. Orbit Gal will welcome you. And who knows? We might be reviewing yours. We're going to review assignments in 2 weeks. So get your, which gives Chris and me both time to take a picture.
Oh, yes.
and something I've been doing, and you don't have to do this, but something I've been doing is trying to find a new picture every time. Not taking old, I have plenty of pictures that could illustrate line, but I want to use this as a chance, as an assignment, as a chance to go out and find something new. Chris Marquardt is at tipsfromthetopfloor.com. That's where his podcast is. If you're interested in his seminars, I'm going to take the one in San Francisco coming in August. Find out more about it by going to, what is it?
DiscoverTheTopFloor.com.
DiscoverTheTopFloor.com. Easy enough. Chris, a great pleasure. We'll talk to you real soon.
Talk to you next week.
And Laporte, the tech guy.
And I want you to take your picture and get it onto Flickr.
Because that's cool, too. Participate. It makes it fun. Jared's in Kansas City. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. What can I do for you today?
I got a question. I'm wanting to get into a Mac.
Okay.
I'm getting old, tired of PCs. And I was just, I was looking, and I want to know the old Mac versus the new one, the new aluminum versus the last year's Core Duo. Is there any real big advantage?
Oh, you mean that Air? You mean that little skinny one? Or you mean...
No.
Okay, so there's two, on the laptops. Oh, you're talking about the desktops.
desktop.
Got it. So you're talking about the Tower Mac Pro versus the iMac.
No. Just the white one versus the new aluminum.
Well, they don't sell the old one anymore.
All right, but you can buy them.
I wouldn't buy them. I'll tell you why. No, actually, the white one was the early generation Intel. So as long as it's Intel, but I think I think the new ones are probably faster. Who's selling the old? Is it, you mean buying it used or?
Yeah, or there's like a smalldog.com.
Yeah, or they sell refurbished. What are the, how do the specs compare? They're pretty similar speeds.
Pretty similar speeds. It's just a different video card.
Yeah.
Some of them have like the NVIDIA. I think it's the 6800.
Yeah, I don't think that makes that much difference. If you're price sensitive, absolutely, I think that's fine. As long, the only key is to make sure it's Intel. I would, at this point, you'd be crazy to buy a G4 or G5 based Macintosh. But if you're buying an Intel, yeah, I'm looking at Small Dog right now. Yeah, I see they do sell, in fact, the older ones. And are they a lot cheaper?
Well, I've seen them for, 800 versus, 1400?
That's a big difference, yeah. Find out if it's refurbed or if it's new.
Uh-huh.
If it is refurbed, is it, factory refurb or does Small Dog refurb it? Who's doing the refurbishment?
Right.
I don't think the white ones are a little slower. I think they're still Core 2s. I'm really trying to remember, and I don't. I'm sorry to say. I think it's probably pretty similar. So, yeah, I think that as long as you're Intel, I think you're fine. And if you're price sensitive, that's a good way to switch. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I like the iMacs a lot. I think they're really nice.
Really nice.
Yeah.
And will that work with the HP home servers?
If you want to use Windows Home Server, yes, it will, but it won't take advantage of all of the features of Home Server because some of them require Windows. Windows Home Server is designed for Windows. Now, sharing files, the iTunes server, that kind of stuff, yes. But Windows-specific stuff, no. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 24/7 on the internet at twit.tv, twit.tv. That's the place to go to find out more and to hear many more shows, including this one, as a podcast. So you can listen to them on your computer or play them on your portable MP3 player in your car, wherever you are. I like the idea. I think that's what consumers want. I really do. I think that they like the idea of moving around, of having their media with them wherever they go, when they want to listen to it. Times have changed. We used to gather together every Sunday to watch the Ed Sullivan Show. Now you gather together whenever you're ready to watch the Ed Sullivan Show. It might be on an airplane. It might be at the gym. And it's certainly not Sunday night. John in Michigan, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
I try to catch you every weekend.
That's great. Thank you.
The question is regarding resetting my IP address.
Yeah.
I've tried all the basic ways that I used to do it. I'm with a new service provider now, and we went through quite an extensive attempt the other day.
Is it cable or DSL?
Pardon me?
Cable or DSL?
It's AT&T UVerse, fiber optic. Internet TV, basically.
Right. So UVerse uses fiber.
Well, fiber optics to the nearest switching station that you have, and then copper wire to your house, and then through your phone line.
Okay, but it's not a DSL technology then?
No, I had DSL prior to that, and okay. All I had to do was basically turn off the modem after I released IP config release. And
so when you get UVerse, do they say you're going to have a dynamic IP address?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And really, they say that probably to protect themselves, because as you noticed with DSL, and this is true with cable, they don't really change it. But they don't want you to assume that you're going to keep the same one.
Okay, well, static IPs cost money.
Right. They want to charge you for that. But the truth is, it's usually pretty static. So why do you want to change your IP address? I guess I should ask that first.
Getting back into a website.
You want to be a different person.
Yes. Nothing nefarious, Leo.
Okay, I'll trust you on that.
You have.
Having blocked many a person in my time. And that's usually how we block people. The problem is it doesn't work very well because for this reason, and if you're on AOL, you can't really block an IP address because every time you dial in, it's a different address and on and on and on.
Uh-huh.
But it is about the only way that websites can filter against people. I don't know. I mean, if AT&T doesn't know, normally resetting the router, you're right, will ask for... It'll ask for a new address. It'll do a new DHCP. Now, you've tried unplugging the router and leaving it off for a while and plugging it in again?
Oh, I left, the first thing I did was just do the regular command, IP config release renew.
Yeah.
And then that won't do it
because your computer...
My laptop. That's just for my modem to my laptop, I found out.
Yeah. That's your 192 address. That's your local address. So, yeah, you'll get a new 192, or maybe you will, but that's not going to help you.
And then prior, as you just said, prior when I had DSL, when I had their two-wire,
just unplug it.
All I had to do was basically unplug it for 10 minutes. Now, in this case, I tried it for 10 minutes, didn't work, then I did it overnight.
Interesting.
Because sometimes it takes 24 hours to process a new IP.
Right.
That didn't work, so I called their tech people, and they tried to reset it from their location.
And they couldn't do it.
And they said this was going to be a test for them because they never even had been requested for
it. I like it.
And well, now I don't know if it's just the fact that they're not aware of how to do it, or they're telling me that based on the router that they gave me, I'm going to have that IP address forever.
Here's my opinion. You essentially have a static IP address. They just, A, don't want to guarantee it in case you set up a server or something and registered it with DNS and all of a sudden it stopped working. Oops. And B, because they want to sell you a static IP address if you want to guarantee it. But I think, in effect, and this is not unusual, you have a permanent IP address. There are other ways to kind of anonymize yourself, and that's if that's all you.
I understand the proxy server issue, but in this case, what I would ever have to do in the past was just, like I say, flip off the modem.
Right. I don't know. I mean, if AT&T doesn't know, maybe somebody who's listening does, but I'm not familiar. I don't. What kind of router are they using? What's the name?
Well, I can't tell other than an AT&T.
Yeah, just a box.
Yeah. It's a significant tower box.
Is it really? And, it's a big old thing, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, half the size of a VCR.
Really?
More flashing lights than I've ever seen on a router.
Huh.
But to be honest with you, if they're telling me that it is specific to that router, if I call them and have them change routers, would that in effect change the IP?
That should. I mean, that's enough of a change. It really, what I don't know, and I apologize, it's just a new technology and I don't know yet, is how they handle it, what they're doing. They probably don't want you to guarantee that you're going to stick with the same IP address, but they probably also don't want to change it particularly. On cable modems, they have particular techniques for querying and getting a new IP address, a DSL router basically does DHCP, and the chances are if you wait long enough, somebody will get a new address, get your address, and so they'll have to give you a new one. And I suspect that's what's going. It may be that's what's going on. It may be that when you had DSL, there were so many DSL customers, you only had to wait 10 minutes for somebody to snag your address, and then you'd get a new one. It may be that so few people have UVerse, it's so new that your address isn't getting snagged up right away. You might have to wait a day or two. I'm looking at message boards that talk about this, and they say, well, my IP has never changed. I've been on UVerse for a month. I don't know. I don't know enough about how it works. I think if you really want to be anonymous, you're going to have to use a proxy or some similar service, an anonymizer, to hide your IP address. That's probably the only way you can do it. And by the way, I just want to point out there are absolutely legitimate reasons to be anonymous on the internet. I accept John's statement that he's not doing anything nefarious. What if you're a whistleblower? What if you're going to a website? What if you're in a 12-step program, for instance, in which you want to preserve your anonymity reasonably so? I'm not saying you are, John. I'm just saying there are lots of good reasons why somebody would want to preserve anonymity that aren't necessarily nefarious. I use PGP. I encrypt my email, not because I'm up to no good, but because I believe I should have some privacy. I think we all deserve it. I'm out of time. I do thank you so much for being here. I hope you'll come back next week. We'll talk more about tech. Retell your friends. I'm online all week, too, on twit.tv or through iTunes. Just do a Google search for Leo Laporte or an iTunes search for Leo Laporte. You'll find me. Have a great week. We'll see you next time. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.